Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with Juan Cole. He's a professor of history at the University of Michigan and has written extensively about Egypt, Iran, Iraq, and South Asia. He's commented extensively on the Iraq War, politics of Pakistan and Afghanistan, also the increasing conflict with Iran. And we'll be talking about his most recent book, and the title is Engaging the Muslim World. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan and has just come out. And in this book, he argues that the Muslim world and the West are at a standoff. Westerners worry about terrorism and intolerance. Muslims are anxious about imperialism and discrimination. And the question that he explores in the book is this: can people on both sides find ways to avoid aggression and move toward greater understanding? And his answer to the question is yes, that is possible. He says that the pressing conflicts between the North Atlantic nations and the Muslim majority ones can be resolved, and certainly better resolved, by engagement than by war and covert operations. Our guest is also somebody who frequently appears on some of the big news programs in radio and television. He's been regular guest on the News Hour on PBS, has also appeared on the ABC Nightly News, on Nightline, on the Today Show with Charlie Rose, and has given many interviews in addition to that. And I do want to mention that he's going to be in Champaign-Urbana this weekend and will be giving a couple of talks. He'll be talking about Iraq and the future of American security on Sunday. This is at the Urbana Civic Center at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And then Monday in the afternoon at 4, Iraq's provincial elections and what they mean for relationships with the United States. And that's taking place at the Levis Faculty Center. These events are co-sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies at the U of I, the Center for Global Studies, the Anti-War, Anti-Racism Effort, and also the Arab Student Association. And these events are all free and open to the public, and certainly anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And this morning on the program, as we talk, questions are welcome, as always, questions, comments. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people are brief with their questions and comments, and we ask that just so that we can keep things moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But, of course, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Professor Cole, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Appreciate it. Just to begin, as a kind of a general point, I want to reinforce the notion that you argue in the book, and that is the kind of conflict that we're talking about. That is the conflict between the West, and there, I suppose, really, we're mostly talking about Europe and the United States. The conflict between the West and the Muslim world, the Islamic world, is not intractable. This is something that indeed can be addressed.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, one of the points I make is that the conflict is not that wide-ranging. When one looks at the Muslim world in the terms of U.S. and NATO diplomacy, there are large numbers of explicit allies there.
Well, what fundamentally do you think is the conflict about? Is it possible actually to reduce it to something fairly simple and basic?
Well, I think there are many dimensions to the conflict. The first and most important one, I think, for most people in the United States would be the issue of terrorism. And I think there, the argument I would make is that terrorism in the Muslim world does exist, but it is a set of small movements and analogous more than anything else to, you know, the Italian Red Brigades or to the American Patriot Movement that produced Timothy McVeigh, that it's not a mainstream sort of thing. And in the last 8 years, one often heard American commentators, you know, talk about the danger of al-Qaeda taking over countries and so forth. And I can't see it. I can't see any likely place that that al-Qaeda can take over a country. There are a few failed states like Somalia and Afghanistan where that kind of radicalism can flourish, but in the, you know, mainstream of the Muslim world, Egypt and Syria and Tunisia and so forth, this is a laughable proposition. So the terrorism issue is there, but it has to be put in in context and looked at in scale. And then there is a set of foreign policy issues. The Muslim world unanimously thinks that Israel is being mean to the Palestinians and beating up on them and keeping them from having their state. The West tends to be more sympathetic to the Israeli point of view. That's an outstanding issue that drives a lot of rancor. The Muslim world, by the polling, does not see the U.S. military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan as either helpful or necessary, and indeed sees it as a form of neo-imperialism. So those policy issues are another dimension. And finally, there's a cultural divide, obviously. But in that regard, the attitudes in the Muslim world towards consumerism, towards sexual license, and so forth, are critical. But they remind me more of culture wars inside the United States, and a lot of people in the United States who are uncomfortable with those aspects of, say, Hollywood morality, just as the Muslim world is.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there are places around the world that you can point to where there are conflicts, some of them long-running conflicts, that seem to have religious, ethnic, and cultural dimensions that also, though, if it's possible to get past those things, are essentially conflicts over resources. To what extent do you think this, and particularly when we're talking about majority of Muslim nations that are located in the Middle East and places where a lot of the world's oil is located, to what extent is this conflict about that? And certainly I know there are people who continue to make the argument that what we have done in the Middle East, our policy there, our involvement in Iraq and so forth, was really all about oil, full stop. That's all there is to it. Now, I think that there's actually more to it than that, but how significant is the competition over that resource?
Yes, well, it is an accident of history that two-thirds of the world's proven petroleum reserves and 45% of the world's known natural gas are in the Persian Gulf, a region which is bordered by Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, and so forth. So obviously those countries are extremely important to the world economy, to the United States economy, and to the economy of America's friends and allies. Japan, for instance, depends heavily on petroleum from the United Arab Emirates, and it's not clear that it can go on being the world's second largest economy if that source were cut off. Moreover, another big new set of fines with regard to oil and gas are in Central Asia, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and so forth. And although those areas had been under Soviet rule, the people there have a Muslim heritage. They're not necessarily practicing Muslims, but they have a Muslim heritage. So it so happens that the big deep reserves of hydrocarbons are in the Muslim world, and that I think does account for some of the conflict, some of the desire on the part of Western elites to dominate that part of the world, and this has been true all through the 20th century. Accounts for the difficulty that the West has in dominating that part of the world, because a petroleum state like Iran is very difficult to dictate to, it's not as if people are not going to buy its oil. So it always has an assured source of income, and it can't be threatened with cut off of loans and so forth so easily as other countries are.
Well, having said that, though, if we said if we could get to a point where our economy was not so dependent on that particular fossil fuel, which I think a lot of people would argue would be a good thing for a variety of reasons, what sort of impact would that have on this particular conflict that we're talking about? And would that actually make a difference, or would there be still a lot of things that we could find that we'd need to talk about and have potential to divide the two worlds, so that you might say, well, that would be a good thing, but that's not going to solve the problem?
Oh, I think that were the world to move quickly to green energy, that it would reduce conflicts over hydrocarbons. It wouldn't reduce some kinds of conflict, obviously, but I think that that could be a positive thing. I warn in the book against over-optimism on how quickly that's going to happen. That is to say, the move to green energy is far more difficult and going to take lots more time than I think most people realize. And I like President Obama a lot, but the idea that we can green America in 10 years is frankly fantastic. It's just not going to happen. We can make strides, but the best estimates of engineers and others who've looked at this are that we could maybe be a third dependent on alternative sources of energy by 2050. So our dependence on hydrocarbons in the United States is likely actually to deepen over the next decades. And moreover, a lot of countries that we now get hydrocarbons from, Mexico, for instance, is our second largest supplier of oil, are running out or starting to use a lot more of it themselves, so that we may not get so much from Mexico in 10 years. And the countries with the really deep reserves that are not going to run out soon and which we will be dependent upon into certainly mid-century are Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, Iran, and so forth. So I say, you know, find a Muslim, make a friend. We're going to need them.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Juan Cole. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan, has written a great deal about the Middle East, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, South Asia. He's done a lot of writing and commentary on the Iraq War, on the politics of Pakistan and Afghanistan, on the increasing conflict between the United States and Iran. And his most recent book is Engaging the Muslim World. It's just out, published by Palgrave Macmillan. And questions certainly here are welcome on the program, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Certainly within the Muslim world, there are people who have very strong ideas about the role that faith should play in both public and private life, and about how the values of faith should shape society and how it's organized. And then, though, having said that, then that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody thinks that that the means to achieve the ideal state are violence, and that violence is appropriate in dealing with people who don't believe as you do. How do you think is it possible for people to get a finer understanding about the range of thought on this, and particularly when it comes to the when people hear about people who believe that states should be organized according to Islamic principles or governed by Islamic law?
Right. So the idea that the state should implement Islamic law is at the center of most of what we typically call the fundamentalist movements in the Muslim world. And very frequently they are reacting against a situation in which there was a colonial regime and in which the British or the French or the Dutch, you know, made the laws for that country. And they are saying, well, you know, we're not British or Dutch. Why should we live according to British or Dutch laws? And this colonial episode, and some of the colonial episodes lasted a long time. I mean, the French were in Algeria from 1830 to 1962. And so deeply shaped the law and administration of that society. So they'll say, you know, we're not French. Why should we live under French law and administration? We should go back to Muslim norms that are in accordance with our own heritage. And that demand for Islamic law is, however, ambiguous because all believing Muslims think they should try to live according to Islamic law. And what would be wrong with, you know, it being incorporated into the law of the state? I mean, Islamic law forbids murder. Wouldn't you want your state to forbid murder? And so forth. And, you know, if you ask Americans, should the United States government be governed in accordance with biblical principles, an amazing percentage says yes. So if it's at that vague level, then it's, I think, not remarkable. But The fundamentalists want to be very specific about it, and they have a whole code drawn from medieval practice that they like to impose on the society. And of course, this has been done in Iran. And not everybody agrees about the specifics. You know, the Quran says the testimony of a woman in court is only worth half that of a man. And in Meccan society and the in Arabia of the 7th century, women were not public figures, and the indication is the reason for that was that women were just not used to speaking in public, and that a another woman should be allowed to come along to prompt her friend and remind her and so forth. But modernist feminist Muslims argue that that's a context that no longer exists, and therefore women's testimony should be equal to that of a man, and are willing to revise the literal text on this issue, and the fundamentalists say no. So there are lots of conflicts inside Islam over how to interpret the Islamic legal heritage.
Well, this gets to this question of how does one separate religion from cultural, historical cultural values that were in place before religion came and were layered over them, and how it is that we in the West think about some of those things that trouble us, and the position of women within some of these societies might be one of those things, where someone might argue, well, in fact, that's really not, that's not about Islam as much as it is about deeply held values that were pre-Islamic. I mean, how does one sort those things out and then try to think about or talk about those things that, as I say, those things that seem to trouble us a lot about some of the places that we're talking about?
Sure. Well, I have a friend, Dennis Candioti, who's argued that there's such a thing as Asian patriarchy, that, you know, the values about the place of women in society among West Asians, who are largely Muslims, South Asians, who are largely Hindus, and Confucianists in East Asia, in pre-modern times, weren't that different. So it's not a matter of Islam or not Islam. It's a matter of Asian folkways. And I think there's something to that. Indeed, one thing that most people don't know about Islamic law is that from the very beginning, it recognized women as independent economic actors and allowed them to have their own property, which was not true of Western law. So if you were a woman in 1600 in most of Europe and you had property as a single person and you got married, your husband became the owner of that property and the sole controller of it after the marriage. It was called couverture as a legal principle. And so I would argue that up until about 1850, when these laws were changed in Europe, Muslim women were probably the wealthiest and most powerful women in the world. There were restrictions on their appearance and behavior in public. But behind the scenes, they were very wealthy sometimes, and sometimes even more or less ruled. So the situation is not always as it seems on the surface, and certainly the principle in Islam of women being individual economic actors in their own right is something that is positive.
We have a caller to bring in to the conversation. Let's do that. Someone who was listening this morning in Effingham on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you, David. I'm going to quote the newspaper today. AP, Hillary Clinton says, "The United States will not recognize any nation having a sphere of influence over any other nation." Which appears to me to be typical of what is wrong with social discourse and interchange that is a very old paradigm based in male-dominated social mores. To make a statement like that seems I have struggled for a word to describe it, because what we do after England and France and Belgium and Portugal, they were among the Western countries the first to begin the invasion of the world on a massive scale, not seen, especially Portugal. And then somehow to make a statement like that seems to be, I hate to use the word, but oxymoron. Do you have any comment to that?
Sure. Well, I think human beings are human beings, and they all behave in relatively similar ways. I mean, I think the differences among cultures are relatively small. You have to learn certain aspects of the game if you enter a new culture, but the ultimate objectives are very similar usually. And so all through history, nations or empires have attempted to establish spheres of influence over others. The United States does it, Europe does it, and the Muslim world does it. And a discourse that seems to imply that we are holier than thou makes no sense, and indeed would make us an object of ridicule in most of the world, since for the last 8 years, the rest of the world at least, has tended to see the United States as a kind of rampaging imperialist power, establishing new spheres of influence all over the place. But I should say that I haven't seen that quote from Secretary of State Clinton. The other news today is that she's inviting Iran to an Afghanistan conference, an international conference on Afghanistan in late March. She's reaching out to the Russians. She's reaching out to the Syrians. And that most of the world is breathing this enormous sigh of relief that the United States is coming to its senses and starting to reach out to potential friendly countries, at least, you know, that might support us on some aspects of some policy. That is to say, the previous administration tended to have a very black and white view of things. Iran has been an ally of the United States in overthrowing Saddam Hussein behind the scenes, and did help the United States overthrow the Taliban and offer all kinds of logistical and other assistance. Wasn't always taken, but the offer was there. But then a decision was made to freeze Iran completely out and to treat it as an enemy on all fronts, which really doesn't make any sense, because there are areas in which cooperation between the United States and Iran would be fruitful for both countries. So I want to express my admiration to Senator Clinton for beginning a change of policy and tone in that regard.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank the caller. I have somebody else here. We're already at our midpoint of the conversation. Again, very quickly, let me introduce our guest, Juan Cole. He's professor of history at the University of Michigan. His most recent book is Engaging the Muslim World, published by Palgrave Macmillan, just came out this month. Also has recently authored the book Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, that came out in 2007. Comments frequently on the politics in the Middle East and the relationship of the United States to the countries, has been on the PBS program The News Hour, also Nightly News, Nightline, Charlie Rose, a number of other programs. He's written extensively about Egypt, Iran, Iraq, South Asia, has commented on the Iraq War, the politics of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and also the increasing conflict with Iran. He has a regular column at Salon.com, and he's going to be here in our area coming up over the next couple of days. Again, a little bit later on, I will run by that information on his talks once again. We do have a caller here, and we'll go on to the next. And this is in the community of Belgium, not all that far away from us, on our line number one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I was wondering, with an area that has produced three of the major religions in the world, innumerable mathematics, arts, just phenomenal development all through this area from northern Africa clear over to India. This area has produced so much positive things for the world. Why in the last 1,000 years has it fallen into such a an area of just disruption of every sort. And would that possibly help us solve the problem today if we understood why they went into this morose situation they've got?
Well, thank you for your question. I guess I would challenge the premise of it, though. What we now think of as the Middle East was part of a number of pre-modern empires. In the last 1,000 years, you would have had the Mamluks in Egypt. You had the Ayyubi dynasty. You had then the Ottoman Empire. And through much of that time, the area was, in world terms, relatively peaceful and prosperous. In fact, the Ottomans were a major world power of their time and were technologically relatively advanced and indeed so powerful that they at some point seemed as though they were going to take over Central Europe. So I take it that you're referring to a kind of decline paradigm or an idea that the Middle East was in, a tailspin culturally, scientifically, and economically in this recent millennium. And the historians don't agree. They don't find that. It is true that from, you can date it at various points, but certainly in the last 400 or 500 years, Europe has demonstrated more economic and scientific vitality. But it's not clear that the Middle East declined so much as that it didn't match Europe's advance. Yes?
No, it's just that I don't understand why they're always at war.
Well, they're not always at war. And indeed, let me just put it to you this way. Between 1914 and 1945, Europe engaged in numerous paroxysms of massive violence, which surely killed, nearly 100 million people. In that period, nothing much going on in the Middle East. And indeed, even since 1945, the sheer number of people killed in Middle Eastern wars, I shouldn't think, even if you include Afghanistan, is more than 5 million or so. So it's a tiny number compared to what Europe killed in the 20th century. So I think we tend to focus more on the wars that happen in the Middle East without realizing that they often have relatively low casualty rates. I'm, a human being is precious, and I don't mean to take away from that, but all of the Arab-Israeli wars, for instance, probably the deaths can be measured in the tens of thousands. So there are severe conflicts in the region now, and there have been in the post-war period. A lot of them are were caused by the colonial heritage, in my view. The problems we've had in Algeria certainly go back to the French occupation of Algeria. The Arab-Israeli conflict has to do with British policy in British Mandate Palestine, which they conquered in World War I. And I would argue that we think of the region as a particularly violent one, largely because the West has intervened there so much that it has left behind a heritage of further conflict.
Thank you very much, sir.
That was, I think, to take it a step further, that was the point that I was going to get to, that I think one could certainly make the argument that with the breakup of the Ottoman Empire that happened after World War I, and then the division of some of those territories among the governments of Europe that created colonies, they didn't exactly put a lot of effort into developing those places. And between that period and the time that then they eventually became independent.
Not only did they not always, the Europeans didn't always develop the regions, they actually sometimes deliberately kept them backwards. So there's a memo from Lord Cromer in 1906 when the British were ruling Egypt, which they did for 40 years, in which he said, well, we educated the Indians and all we did was to create this Congress movement which wants independence and to kick us out. So we're not going to educate the Egyptians. So during the British period, there weren't great strides in Egyptian literacy or schooling, and it was deliberate on the British part. There were a lot of stories like that, and I think one of the problems that a lot of Americans have in understanding the contemporary Middle East is that they don't know about the long history of Western colonialism in the region. They mostly don't know how much Westerners have had to do with that area, including in ruling it and ordering it around and so forth, and so can't understand the resentments that people have about further what they see as neo-imperialism, or now, you know, the flexing of American power in the region.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk with someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, this matter of constant warfare in the Middle East, of course, seems to be a myth that is very prevalent here in the United States. If you look at the history of the Middle East, most of the conflict has not been as a result of Middle Easterners fighting Middle Easterners, but of outsiders invading the Middle East. And I point to the Mongols and following the Mongols, Timur, who were the most bloodthirsty of all of the Middle East wars. The Middle Easterners tended, when they did have conflict, not to kill women and children and try to avoid the killing of non-combatants in general. If you contrast this with the Europeans from about 1500 on with the religious wars and then the two world wars, the Middle East has been an area of tranquility.
Well, I don't disagree. I think there are lots of things about the Middle East that made it more difficult to have the large-scale kinds of bloodshed that you had in Europe. It's an arid area. It's difficult to marshal very large armies. It's thinly populated. It's rugged. So Iran, for instance, hasn't launched an aggressive war against a neighbor probably since about 1785. But it's not that Iranians are angels, that they're different from other human beings or less aggressive and so forth. It's that Iran is over three times the size of France. It's a very rugged country. It was thinly populated, and you wouldn't have been able to marshal the Iranians into an aggressive war very easily. So I agree entirely with the caller's point that there's a lot of image-making about the Middle East, and it strikes me that were you born in Tunisia in 1950, you would have lived all your life without your country having been actively at war. There are lots of places in the Middle East where warfare has been a relatively minor part of life. In the West, we tend to think of it as a particularly volatile region, but it's not that way everywhere and always.
I would also like to point to the Palestinian area, where for about 500 years following the expulsion of the Sephardic Jews from Europe, Jews and Muslims lived in comparative good relations until the European Zionists appeared on the scene. Contrast this with Europe.
Sure. Well, you know, there were long periods in which entire countries excluded Jews in the medieval period in Europe, Britain, Spain. In fact, in 1492, when the Reconquista expelled the Muslims from Spain, Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand issued a decree on this subject, in which they said that one of the reasons that they were expelling the Muslims from Spain was that they tolerated Jews, and it is part of Islamic law and Islamic heritage that Christians and Jews and other monotheistic religious communities have the right to worship, to enjoy the liberty of life and property in Muslim societies. And in the medieval period, this made the Muslim world far more cosmopolitan and open than Europe which excluded non-Christians for the most part. And sometimes, you know, you had like the wars of religion in which the Christians were pretty intolerant of one another. So, yeah, the image of the Middle East as somehow fanatical and intolerant and so forth, I think is a cultural artifact. And on the other hand, of course, non-Muslims in pre-modern Muslim societies were kind of second-class citizens, and I don't mean to, you know, invent golden ages or to gloss over the fact that there were sometimes pogroms and so forth. But the legal structures in the Muslim world, I think, were far more enlightened about a multicultural approach than was typical of Europe until the Enlightenment.
We're moving into about our last 10 minutes. Yeah, and I have someone else here. I hope the caller will forgive me for moving on. I appreciate his comments. Let's go to Clinton, Iowa, and the toll-free line 4. Hello.
Hello, thank you. Yes. Thank you for taking my call. This is a little complicated because this last caller hit on something I didn't think of. Midway through the Crusades, they had what they called second-generation crusaders. Those are young children that were born over in the Arab lands. And when they decided for in the West to launch another crusade, the second-generation crusaders met, I believe it was Philip of France and the emissary of the king from England, at the Sea of Marmara and said, there's no need to do this because we found a way, the Christians, the Jews, and Arabs, they're all living together. And they tried to convince them not to go, not to launch this crusade. And England and Philip and France's emissaries concurred, but this Pelagianese emissary from the Pope said, you know, we will not deal with Saracens. And hence that crusade went on and killed hundreds of thousands. So there was a great deal of living together during that time period. But on to my question, Armin Maalouf, had your guest read any of his stories?
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch it. Oh, Armin Maalouf, yes.
Yeah. Well, He's written several books, and I think they're fairly unbiased. And he said that he couldn't understand why, after the Crusades, the Arab world went into this kind of tailspin. And one of his hypotheses was, he said that there was a broad thread of brutality that ran through Islam. And the radicals adhere and propagate it. The balance of the Muslims ignore it. And until the balance of the Muslims come to grips with this themselves, there's nothing that the West can do to try to interact with Islam. And we know that Muslims, you know, can demonstrate. We've seen that with satanic verses, statements by the Pope, cartoons from Denmark, and they can rally hundreds of thousands in the street, but we don't see any demonstrations against radical Islam. And his theory was that the Muslims have to kind of straighten this out themselves before Christianity can have any long-term interactions with them.
Yes, this is a common view that Muslims sort of are peculiarly violent or intolerant and somehow don't mobilize to stop the radicals in their midst and so forth. I don't agree, and I think that it's another kind of myth-making that's going on there, and sometimes Middle Eastern Christians or secularists like Armin Maalouf contribute to it. There's no evidence of a decline in the Arab world in the medieval period or the early modern period. There's no evidence that Muslims have been more violent than other people in history. In fact, the murder rates in places like Egypt are a fraction of what they are in the United States. In fact, Muslims demonstrate against intolerance all the time. We had in Pakistan during the past 2 years large demonstrations against authoritarianism, against violence. People have denounced the Taliban. I saw with my own eyes demonstrations in Beirut against the ongoing violence of the civil war. Al-Qaeda has been condemned by all the major Muslim authorities. The Al-Azhar Seminary in Egypt, which is the preeminent legal authority in the Sunni world, has condemned fanaticism in Al-Qaeda and so forth. And so I think part of the problem here is that most Westerners don't know what the authority centers for Muslims are. And so they can't see it when those centers condemn violence. And then news tends from the Middle East tends to focus on, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. And so a demonstration organized by housewives in Beirut against violence just would never get on our wire services. So I really would challenge the premises of the question.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. And this gets at a question that I did want to pose, and to which I think that you've really already responded, and that is that, for example, look back to 9/11. After 9/11 happened, there were many Muslims who came forward and said, we think this is wrong. This does not represent our values. We don't think this represents Islamic values. We would condemn this act in the strongest possible terms. And then it seems, though, that either that wasn't enough for us, or that we wanted to see Muslims in the Muslim world standing up and saying that. So it sounds as if what you're saying is that, in fact, people in the Muslim world, not only just average people, but people who were leaders in the Muslim world actually have done that, but that for some reason, we here in the United States haven't heard it.
That's right. You take a place like Egypt. After the 1997 shooting of tourists at Luxor by the Egyptian Islamic Jihad of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the whole Egyptian public swung around and with just outrage and distaste towards these radical Muslim movements. And they declined so totally in public estimation, and so many of them were imprisoned, that they themselves began rethinking their programs. And in the past 5 years, the leading violent group, Gamal al-Islamiyah, or the Islamic grouping in Egypt, which was implicated in the first World Trade bombing in the United States, and the blind sheikh was a leader, they've become more or less pacifist. They've announced that they've rethought their approach to Islam. They think it was wrong of them to pursue this kind of vigilante violence, and that the Quran and the Islamic tradition command them to work in more peaceful ways towards their goals. And they've issued 20 what are called recantation pamphlets. So you have this major violent movement which roiled Egypt and which actually was responsible for an attack in the United States, which has made a 180-degree turn. And yet this development, which I think is significant, is completely unknown to the American public or to the punditry here.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Juan Cole. He's professor of history at University of Michigan, has written a lot about the politics of the Middle East and the relationship between the Islamic world and majority Muslim countries and the West and the United States. His most recent book is Engaging the Muslim World, published by Palgrave Macmillan just this month. And questions are welcome. We have about 6-7 minutes, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, coming back then again, or continuing to talk about the subject of terrorism, as you said in the beginning of the program, that yes, there are groups, terrorist groups, like Al-Qaeda, for example, but that they are small movements. They're not mainstream. And one of the problems that we have seen is that they're also scattered. And if you're going to decide that you're going to use military force against them, it's maybe not an easy thing to do to find them. So that calls into question the whole program of the war on terror and whether ultimately a military kind of approach is going to take care of the problem.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conceptual confusion about the previous administration's war on terror. All kinds of things were wrought up with it. You had the secular Arab nationalist government of Saddam Hussein was somehow, they tried to associate it with Al-Qaeda, which was a dire enemy of it, in fact. And then a Pashtun cultural movement like the Taliban were configured as international terrorism, whereas as far as anyone can tell, the Afghan Taliban or Pashtuns really didn't play on a world stage. They were very much local to Afghanistan. and Pakistan. So it, I think that, you know, if terrorism is the problem, well, terrorist groups tend to be small, and they are best dealt with police action and techniques. And the Egyptians, I think, have shown that fairly significant terrorist groups can be dealt with by good policing and by bureaucratic means, more or less, rather than military ones. So this idea that the Pentagon can somehow deal with these terrorist groups, international terrorism, seems to me to be flawed. And I think that what happened with Iraq was that they, you know, overthrew a secular Arab nationalist government and occupied an Arab Muslim country. And people reacted by swinging towards religious views and organizing themselves to oppose the American presence by religious organizations. And it provoked an enormous amount of terrorism. I think it got Madrid blown up. It got London and Leeds blown up. And so it's, you know, counterproductive to go at it that way.
Going back to this this question about the values, perhaps cultural values that divide us, do you think that it is the case that at some point that that we and they, the West and the Islamic world, and I use that phrase knowing that it's a vast sort of broad brush kind of painting of what's some more complicated and more subtle and more interesting than that. But will we have simply have to get to the point where when it comes to some of these things that divide us, we simply say we're going to have to agree to differ, and we're going to have to say, well, you know, maybe there are some things we'd like to see different, but they're not changes that we can force. And for that reason, we're simply going to have to say, well, we'll just set that aside for the moment and go on.
Yeah, well, I think relatively few of the cultural differences between the United States and most people in the Muslim world are amenable to government action. I mean, it is the case that Muslim societies are largely patriarchal, and that in some of them, in particular, Saudi Arabia, Iran, the treatment of women is objectionable from an American point of view. But, you know, from their point of view, who is America to come in and dictate to them how they treat their women? And I think there are ways of putting pressure on them to change that. It's certainly not the case that military intervention can change it. You look at Iraq, actually, the position of women declined after the Americans overthrew the secular government. So there are those cultural differences, but I think with regard to values like democracy and so forth, the opinion polling shows that the Muslims of the world are really yearning for democratic values and democratic institutions, and don't, on the whole, see a conflict between Islam and democracy. And we have had a number of success stories, which, again, the American public hasn't tended to notice. But Indonesia, since 1999, has the world's largest Muslim country, has moved to a fairly stable, open society with free elections and a free press. Pakistan just mounted a popular movement to overthrow its military dictator, Parvez Musharraf, and install an elected government. There are problems with that government. There are problems with stability in Pakistan. But I think because the dictator, Parvez Musharraf, was an ally of the Bush administration in the war on terror, the good news story about Pakistan moving to democracy hasn't been seen that way in the U.S. press. But I think there's less conflict on some of those values than is commonly assumed.
Well, and at the same time, I suppose it doesn't help that there are governments who are not democratic that are ostensibly at least our friends and allies that we continue to support, maybe to name two, Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
Yes, well, Saudi Arabia in particular is a conundrum for American policy because virtually any of the critiques that the United States makes of, say, Iran could also be made of Saudi Arabia, and yet one is an ally, the other is coded as an enemy. Sort of thing is seen as hypocrisy on the American part in the region.
Well, I think that we're just about at the point we're going to have to finish, and we've come to the end of the time, so we're going to have to stop. However, I do want to make sure that people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, know that our guest for this morning, Juan Cole, is going to be giving two talks, and they are certainly open to anyone who would like to attend. He'll be speaking at the Urbana Civic Center on Sunday, 2 in the afternoon, on the subject withdrawal from Iraq and the future of American security. And then he will talk on Monday at 4 in the afternoon on Iraq's provincial elections and what they mean for relationships with the U.S. That's at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. That's also in Urbana. And these events are co-sponsored by the Center for South Asian and Middle Eastern Studies, the Center for Global Studies, the Anti-War, Anti-Racism Effort, and the Arab Student Association. And if people are interested, they can stop by. Also, you might want to look at Juan Cole's most recent book. The title is Engaging the Muslim World, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. Our guest, Juan Cole, is professor of history at the University of Michigan. And Professor Cole, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my great pleasure, David. Thank you.